Just a Life show. My name's Robin Daly, and in the show, I explore some of the many avenues that constitute integrative medicine for cancer, the broadest and the most inclusive approach to meeting the many challenges of treating and recovering from cancer. At present, I'm in the midst of a series of shows based around the forthcoming book, The Cancer Revolution. Written by integrative medicine expert Patricia Peat and 37 other expert contributors, and to be sold from the 21st of April entirely in aid of Yes to Life. This week I have two fascinating guests, both expert contributors to the book, speaking about very different topics. My first guest is Dr. Zandria Williams, an enormously experienced and highly qualified naturopath who's made a speciality of supporting people with cancer and who has written extensively on the subject. I visited Andrea to speak to her at her home and practice near Sloane Square in central London.
Good afternoon, Andrea. Lovely Hi. To talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show, and thank you particularly for contributing to the Cancer Revolution.
My pleasure.
Great. So you very kindly contributed two important sections to the book, the first on the science behind integrative medicine and the second on the dangers of glucose. I know you're a highly qualified scientist, chemist and biochemist, and you set great store by research personally. In the UK, one of the most common responses that oncologists give to integrative approaches is just to say, well, there isn't any evidence. That's a sort of standard reply.
No, what they mean is they haven't read any evidence. There is a mass of it.
Well, that was what I was going to just ask you about. Maybe you could say a little bit about the evidence base, both for its safety and its efficacy.
Well, in terms of quantity, it's almost like there's a glass wall between all the clinicians, the oncologists, radiologists, the medical profession and the like, and the research. And there's an immense amount of research written up in peer-reviewed, PubMed, mainstream, university, science department journals, with immense amount of background to everything that I do. I don't believe in anything. I look for the research and get the results. Take something like curcumin, and you'll get the radiologist I talked to recently when I said, oh, well, there's no evidence that does anything at all. There are over 5,000 papers on the benefit and the activity of curcumin in terms of cancer, of improving the outcome of things like radiation treatment, for instance, not interfering with it. And the mechanisms by which it will work. I look at a second test panel for people who we think have cancer or know they have cancer, to look at the various genes that are mutated, like protein 53, which is your guardian of the threshold. Protein 53, if it's active, will stop any damaged cells from living. You can go online and do the research in not chatty papers, but technical papers, at the way a whole lot of different plant compounds react beneficially with the level of protein 53. You can't get much more scientific than that, or whether you've got enough of BAX or not enough or too much BCL2, which would inhibit apoptosis. It's in there. But many doctors will say to me things like, because I meet them at my clubs for dinner or whatever, well, you know, what's the science? And I start telling them about the biochemistry, and you can see them glazing over. They've long since forgotten the biochemistry that they did at medical school. What they really mean is they haven't read it. I rarely read a paper, and I read several often in a day or look at several in a day, that doesn't have more than 100 or 200 references at the bottom of mainstream research. It's there.
Okay, so it's a myth. That there isn't.
Well, they should look into it.
Right.
And not just say, well, it doesn't exist because I don't know it exists. They should go and have a look and see if it exists.
But very importantly, people who are interested in maybe using integrative methods to support themselves shouldn't be put off by that kind of comment.
Well, I think most people today know how to go on to the, you know, we use Google almost as a verb. And if they Google things like simple things, they look at fennel and cancer. They'll get some papers into the benefit of some of the components of fennel or some of the components of basil or some of the components of any food or herb or plant that they'd come across without going into the more esoteric compounds like resveratrol or quercetin or things that, you know, the lay person hasn't heard of. They just need to Google them and see. And there's a stack of papers.
Okay, and how about the dangerous thing gets thrown at people about, you know, mixing these things up and it's a dangerous thing to do? How do you see integrative methods in terms of their safety?
Generally? Well, when you say mixing things up, we mix things up on our plate every day when we eat
That's
a meal.
True.
And, you know, somebody came to me the other day and they'd been told not to take any carotene, it's bad for you. Well, they didn't tell them not to eat carrots or not to eat green vegetables. We mix them all the time. And if you look, there's a book by Ralph Moss. He's looked very carefully into the possible dangers of using antioxidants, for instance, because you know, the common wisdom is that many chemotherapy agents are very strong oxidizing agents and therefore damage the cells. His attitude is looking at it that those oxidizing agents are so strong that the plant antioxidants don't really have a chance. And many times when people say, either they've come to seminars or lectures or spoken to me in various contexts, oh, but I was told by my oncologist that this and that, I say, you know, that's really interesting. Just ask them for the paper because I'd really like to read it. And they've never yet come back with any oncologist who's given them a single paper to show that anything is harmful. They just get told that as a blanket. No, no, don't do that while we're treating you. It's a sort of knee-jerk reaction. But the same people don't say, eat more vegetables or cut out sugar and processed food and white bread and burnt fats. That doesn't seem to bother them. And yet those things are immensely harmful.
Okay, but nonetheless, I'm sure you'd feel that people who are taking any kind of integrative approach, by which I mean they're adding in anything to their, say they're doing orthodox therapy, are wise to have somebody expert in tow to consult about what to use.
Well, yes, but who's the expert? I mean, the oncologists don't know what the food components are doing. So they're not, I mean, ideally, they should know exactly what would be the effect of adding quercetin or N-acetylcysteine or anything else. But they don't. In fact, the people that know, hopefully the people I and the likes of myself train and teach.
So that's what I'm saying. They maybe should have some kind of integrative practitioner behind them, either a skilled nutritionist with cancer experience.
Trouble you've got there, though, and I do sympathise with the medically trained doctors who've got a licence to lose. If they get too involved in understanding the non-drug side, I'm nervous of words like alternative and complementary because they're kind of loaded. But if you get a doctor who decides to look at using plant compounds or vitamins or nutrients or the like, then they're very quickly told they're practicing non-standard drug medicine and they can lose their license. So that the system works against them finding out, and if they do find out, it works against them using it. Makes it difficult.
It is very difficult, I agree.
At least the non-drug doctor practitioners don't have a license to lose.
No, that's true. Okay, so can we move on now and take a look at the whole question of glucose and cancer? Now, it's a subject that's been experiencing an exciting renewal of interest just recently. For decades, the kind of three commandments of alternative practitioners to people with cancer have been, you know, to increase their oxygen levels, alkalize their body, and reduce sugar intake. And those things, they've been largely dismissed as nonsense by orthodox medicine. But just recently, there's been some great science, international level science coming along to show that maybe these things make a lot more sense than they thought. There's also a great upsurge of interest in the ketogenic diet as well around cancer. So maybe you could just start at the beginning and tell us the whole story of you know, where the sugar feeds cancer comes from.
Right. Well, you asked for the whole story. We can go back, well, 100 or more years to Otto Warburg, Nobel Prize winner, who says, and it is still has not been refuted, and it is increasingly becoming accepted in thoughtful scientific circles and approaches to cancer. The ultimate cause of cancer is simple, and it's one thing. It's the failure of mitochondria, the little engine energy-generating powerhouses in the cell, of which each cell's got an average of about 1,000. When they fail, you get cancer. The rest of the cell ferments. That then changes the genetic changes. Now, the doctors attack the genetic changes. It's like taking the plant flower heads off the weeds. Doesn't get down to the mitochondrial level. Warburg said, ultimately, it's a failure of oxygen into the cells, which causes mitochondrial failure, and that's hugely aggravated by a lack of all essential nutrients, which means lots more vegetables, essentially, the presence of toxins and stress. In the cells, the glucose has to be dealt with in the mitochondria, about 95%. Protein and fats are nearly at a first level of simplicity. Proteins and fats are entirely dealt with in the mitochondria. The rest of the cell, if it's a cancer cell with damaged mitochondria, has to have glucose to get energy. And to make sure that those cells get enough glucose, they have arguably up to about 10 times as many receptor sites for glucose as do healthy cells. And some study papers, I don't know how they managed to do this, but they say some of the cells, cancer cells, actually make their own insulin or their own chemical facilitation to even further improve the glucose into the cells. This means that if you cut out glucose nearly totally, it's very hard to cut it out totally, and arguably your brain needs a small amount and maybe it doesn't, but you can hugely increase, or if you put it the other way, you can decrease the viability of cancer cells by starving them. If you have too much glucose and these damaged mitochondria, of which you've got 1,000 in each cell, can't process the partial breakdown of glucose, then it starts to ferment, then it starts to make lactic acid. The lactic acid makes cells multiply faster, and you've got a recipe for cancer. And it's not just sugar. I keep saying glucose on purpose.
Yes.
And you get glucose from all the high starch foods. Wheat, barley, oats, rye, pasta, bread, biscuits, cakes, buns, cookies, of which our diet now is massively composed. So the thing behind the ketogenic diet, which is a term we perhaps should even explore a bit, but is that you take the diet down so far in terms of glucose that the cells readapt to getting all their energy from fats and creating ketones, and then the brain uses ketones for energy. But many people say, oh, I'm on a paleo diet. And they mean they've sort of cut down sugar a bit, but they're still getting maybe 100 grams or more of carbohydrates in the day. Or they'll say, I'm on a ketogenic diet. They're not actually generating ketones, but they're on a moderate protein, higher fat, hopefully very high vegetable diet with very little carbohydrate. Actually getting into ketosis without going into ketoacidosis is quite a technical thing. Let's say you're going to try and have 30 grams of carbohydrate in the day. You'll get 10 grams just from a handful of almonds. And yet we think of almonds as protein and fat. Mm. So it's
pretty tricky.
It's an extreme thing, and yeah. I'm not sure it's always what. And it depends on the person's metabolism. Some people, it's like having cars and saying, do I put petrol or diesel in? Well, I want to know if it's a petrol-type car or a diesel-type car. No two patients leave my office with the same protocol.
Right. Okay.
You need to know if they're somebody who is really more inclined to do well on meat will do well on a ketogenic diet. Somebody who is really not inclined to eat high amounts of fat and protein and the like are going to have struggle. And I'm not sure it's necessarily the right one for them. Depends on their metabolism.
Okay, well, that's already answered one of the questions I was going to ask a little bit about the ketogenic diet and how you saw it, because it's put forward as a one-size-fits-all
solution. None of this is one-size-fits-all. For some people, they're already too alkaline. For some people, a meat diet's much more alkalizing than a vegetable diet. This isn't taken into account enough. Mm. I hear this all this time. Everything you read, everybody should eat this way. No, everybody should eat that way. And that's never going to be true.
Okay, well, let's go back a step if we can, and let's if we could just go into a little bit more detail on the mechanism of ketosis. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but enough so people understand the difference between a low-carb diet and actually one that pushes you into ketosis and why that's important. Why? What is ketosis? Why does that matter?
Going onto a diet with sufficiently restrictive carbohydrates is a sort of click-off point somewhere, you know, you're there or you're not there. Inside, I don't know if you want this much detail, but inside the cells, you've got the Krebs cycle, the citric acid cycle, that is like the, imagine it like a merry-go-round at a fair. And imagine you've got, say, let's say, sacks you put on the merry-go-round, it whirls round, and parts of the sack are thrown off at four or five different points. That's where proteins go on and the bits get metabolized off. Fats go on, the bits get metabolized off. And carbohydrates get partially broken down, prepared for that in the rest of the cell. That's where the cancer cells get their little bit of energy. And then they get on that whirly bird and get broken down. Now, if you have sufficiently little carbohydrate in the form of glucose, you can't keep restoring that merry-go-round because every so often you need to replenish some of the components of it. When that happens, the fat and the protein that goes into it can't get broken down any further. And so instead of making fats into ketones and then into carbon dioxide and water, you get fats going into ketones and can't go any further. If you then lose those ketones in the urine, they're really going out with about 80% of the calories of the diet. But because that cycle's not functioning, you're not going to get any energy out of the glucose. That does mean cutting the carbohydrate down to the point where you stop that Krebs cycle running and you get these ketones generated. There are three of them. And those ketones can then feed the brain, which does very well on them. But in the old days, sort of 30 or 40 years ago, when I was first in practice, there was the Atkins diet, the low carbohydrate, and that was sort of 60 grams of carbohydrate a day. To really get into steady ketosis, you know, I mean, a small bowl of raspberries is about 10 grams of carbohydrate, and if you're trying to get down to below 20 or 30 in the day, I mean, you can have a few lettuce leaves, but you better not eat a carrot.
Right.
It's very hard to do. I've put myself on every regime I've ever put any patient on, which no doctor can say.
All right.
And just recently, a couple of weeks back, I thought, well, I really better try the complete ketosis diet. And it's absolutely not my style of eating. I don't like meat. I don't eat meat. I eat a lot more vegetables like. But I thought, I really will try this. And by the time I'd had sort of eggs and smoked salmon for breakfast and fish for lunch and maybe some fish for dinner and a few lettuce leaves and a few herbs and the like for 3 days. Oh. But then I've got one chap who comes, he's one of the students where I teach at the college, and I mean, his breakfast is five eggs every morning and he loves it. And he has 2 or 3 ounces of butter just to really make it taste. And it's perfect for him. And he's way onto ketogenic. Now, before that, I didn't know him before that, but he tells me before that, he had problems with allergies, with indigestion, with mood swings, with blood sugar levels going up and down. Now he's flat as, you know, perfect health, very quiet, very steady.
It does really work in some situations, it seems.
For some
it?
People.
Yeah, some people. I mean, you know, there's remarkable stories of containing very difficult cancers for them, aren't there?
And a lot of other things, Parkinson's disease, autism, epilepsy, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Because nearly every degenerative disease that we've got, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, autism, behaviours, Parkinson's, they all fundamentally have mitochondrial failure at their heart. And that is these precious little things. And Warburg, bless him, and his brilliant brain, he barely knew what went on inside the mitochondria, but he figured out. And the more we learn, and there's this excellent book by Seyfried, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. I mean, that is such an exciting biochemical book. he's gone right into the depths of what Warburg was saying and hadn't even dreamt of, and just proves Warburg for one thing.
Mm.
But of course, you can't make any money out of trying to make people healthy that way.
No, you can't. But nevertheless, there seems to have been a very groundbreaking book, that one, even though it's definitely not my idea of bedtime reading.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It seems to have had a big impact.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's another interesting book, The Emperor of All Diseases, which looks at the history of the development of radiation chemotherapy. And you realise how much that is like just a painter just throwing paints at the wall and hoping he gets a picture.
Mm.
And then there's a much more readable, light-ish book that seems to have been written about 4 or 5, 6 years after The Emperor of All Diseases. In a way, it recaps that book more superficially and then goes a little bit further and takes us into the whole biochemical metabolic approach to cancer and into the ketogenic diet. And that's, I think it's called Stumbling Over the Truth.
Or Tripping Over the Truth.
Tripping Over the Truth.
Mr. Christopherson.
And that, yeah. I think, yes, Christopherson. I suspect most people could read that.
Oh, I've read that one, yes. No, it's a good read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm looking forward to having Mr. Christopherson to speak for us, actually, in the autumn.
Yeah.
All right, well, look, that's very interesting. So the key simple message behind that is that these ketones, they are useful fuel to healthy cells in general, but then they're not useful to rogue cells or cells.
They're not useful to cancer cells.
No.
But I do think you have to do the ketogenic diet under advice from somebody
this
who's specialised in that field, because otherwise you might think you're doing it, you might not, and you've got to see what's right for that individual.
Mm.
Absolutely have to.
So one last thing. I mentioned these kind of three basic tenets that, you know, all sort of alternative doctors.
No, there are four.
There are four. Sorry, come
Oxygen,
on.
Oxygen.
Yes.
Lack of nutrients. Excessive toxins. Stress sounds too easy to say, but we understand the physiology and biochemistry now of stress so thoroughly that you can't... Mm. For one thing, stress exhausts your adrenal glands. The lack of adrenaline means your blood doesn't flow. The blood doesn't flow down all the tiny capillaries. You don't get oxygen to the cells. Lack of oxygen causes cancer. And we're back to Warburg's first statement.
Okay.
It's those four things. Now, the ketogenic diet is part of cutting out glucose and not stressing the mitochondria.
Okay. So what I was going to ask was,
do you
put anything as being the most significant of these things or the most important? Would you put more emphasis?
No.
Do you think they're all
equally
important? A
car's got four wheels. You've got to have all four.
Okay, this was the kind of thing I wanted to
say. You have to have the good diet without the bad fats, which is all the trans fats and overheated fats and processed oils. You've got to have a glucose minimal diet with maximum trace nutrients in it. You've got to do a very thorough detox. You need to look at the stress component. Most people developing cancer will have said they had some form of major stress a year, 2, 3 years before they're diagnosed.
Yes.
It may have been sitting there for 10 years. And then you get a major stress and it triggers it up. And we need to get oxygen in the cells, which isn't just deep breathing. This is where we use the essential fatty acids combined with proteins and improve the oxygen uptake by improving the cell walls. And the cell walls, after all, are the brain of the cell. You've got to get them functioning properly. And it's structured. It's beautiful. It's the most exciting part of my career of 40-odd years because the whole approach to cancer is so layered and structured and logical and biochemistically sound.
Mm.
And you can get such good results.
That's good, isn't it? Yes, as you say, it's been a bit of a random business.
Oh, the chemotherapy is wildly random.
Yeah. And lastly, just while we're, you know, on the diet front, just give us an idea of the kind of diet that you would be recommending. Obviously, you say it's an individual thing, but there's definite things I'm sure that you'd be saying to everybody. And so what a general diet for somebody in order to lower their glucose input, what's it going to have in it? What's it not going to have in it?
Assuming you've got somebody with cancer right now.
Yeah.
For some of them, eggs and a side salad or an omelette with some vegetables is a good breakfast. But for many of them, and it happens that most of the people that get cancer tend to be the type that don't want a big high-protein diet. But that's only slight correlation. I generally suggest that the only fruit they have is the berries, because berries give you a lot of trace benefits with minimal glucose.
Okay.
Look at the work of Dr. Budvig, who combined, I suggest, yogurt if they do want to have yogurt, dairy products, otherwise plant proteins like hemp protein or rice protein, and a bit of a liquid, and then combine that with flaxseed oil. But you've got to treat the flaxseed oil property and keep it in the deep freeze, not in the fridge. And that blending helps get the essential fatty acids into the cell walls, and then the cell walls become flexible and active, and they take in nutrients and get rid of rubbish. And then they have a diet that is as much vegetables as they can manage. And this is where people like Gerson and the people at Hippocrates and Wigmore and the like, years before we had all the supplements you've got now, said, you know, drink a litre of above-ground, well, I would say above-ground vegetable juices in the day, one or two carrots, but mostly above-ground. That gets you a lot of the several, couple of thousand or more plant nutrients that we know about. I mean, when I started, we knew about 3 bioflavonoids.
Oh, right.
Now we know about several hundreds of them, many hundreds of them. So lots of vegetables in juices, lots of vegetables in salads. But it's not just a case of lettuce, tomato, cucumber, beetroot. Lettuce, tomato, cucumber, beetroot. And you can't just go out and buy the average raw food cookbook, because they're full of grains and bananas and dates and all sorts of sugar-rich things. And this is where I took my chemistry into the kitchen and started dreaming up all sorts of recipes. For instance, I made the other day, you take the carrot pulp after you've made the juice and say the pulp from things like the broccoli and the peppers, which is quite nice pulp, and then mix that with nuts and put it all through the juice extractor of masticating type 2 or 3 times, so you get a sort of a sausage-like mush out of it. Add a bit of xylitol, a bit of spices, dry it in the dehydrator and make carrot cake. You know, you can do all sorts of things.
Sounds creative.
So I wrote this book. You can see those red copies over there. It's about 185 A4 pages of recipes that you can do things and have. I mean, I've given dinner parties on nut burgers and veggie burgers, and it's all raw, it's all dehydrated, it's all fresh vegetables. I mean, one couple will only come for dinner if I give them raspberry ice cream, and it's in there made from frozen raspberries and the yogurt oil mixture. So I make the book and sell it now to patients and clients or anyone that wants it, but it's not printed.
Right. So, okay, well, that's a lot of the things you do go for. What are the unexpected things that you actually need to avoid, the things where there's a surprising amount of glucose gets in the system?
Well, going back to the average diet, I mean, you people drink a soft drink. There's about 2 or 3 tablespoons of sugar.
Those are the ones beginning to be known about now. But, yeah, there's a lot of other places it's hiding there.
Well, many people think that, oh, brown rice is all right instead of white.
Exactly.
And it's only about 10% better. Mm. You know, it's a little bit better. If somebody's got cancer and they really want to get over it, they need to cut out all the grains. I mean, you go back 10,000 years, we didn't eat grains. The only reason we ate grains was when we were persuaded to, because you can store grains in a hut somewhere and live through the winter without going off hunting woolly mammoths. And in those 10,000 years, our bodies genetically have only moderately adapted. It's why we have so many people with wheat allergies or gluten sensitivities. We're not really ripe for those foods. One of the most things that most people are surprised at, and is in pretty nearly everything you buy in a tin or a packet or a jar, are the various vegetable oils, of which sunflower seed oil seems to be the most pervasive. Mm-hmm. And yet to get the oil out of the sunflower seeds, you do a lot of harmful processing. But I've had many people over the 40-odd years who've changed their diet and finally say, gosh, wow, this is fine. I don't want to go back to what I was doing before. It's just understanding the changes they need to make and getting a bit of help to start. That's why we have sort of patient open houses in my office, and they come and they see what you can cook, or they bring different things. I say cook, but mostly it's raw prepared. There's a whole new world beyond our common foods of commerce that are not making us healthy.
So that's actually one pretty good rule, is that actually food that's been produced by industry always tends to have extra sugar in it, just in
sugar
order to sell
and
it.
Sunflower oil, and then processed trans fatty acids. People, I mean, I wrote an article in 1979 warning of the dangers of trans fatty acids. Met a chap who I was told was in the butter industry. It turned out he was in the vegetable oil industry. He finally admitted, "We know the danger of trans fats, but it is better for us to have trans fats in our margarines because they are more solid and still more unsaturated, so we can get higher marks for selling them. But we're also preparing margarines with cis fats for when the balloon goes up and people realise the dangers." That was in 1979.
Wow. Well, they got a good innings, didn't they?
They're still at it.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, I think that's all we've got time for. Thank you once again for coming on the Yes Life show today, and particularly for contributing to our book. Your brilliant contributions.
Great book.
Thank you.
I wish you good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Next, I'm speaking to another naturopath and also a functional medicine practitioner, Bob Jacobs. Bob has also had extensive experience of helping people with cancer, and he places a heavy reliance on some of the recently developed tests in order to evaluate how best to provide support. I visited him in his practice near the Wallace Collection in central London to ask him to explain these tests and how and why he uses them. Hi Bob, great to see you again, and thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure, great to see you.
So I was delighted that you agreed to contribute to the cancer revolution, as you've got considerable experience supporting people with cancer as a naturopath and as a functional medicine practitioner. The section you contributed to the book is about functional testing. Now, I know that you use functional tests yourself, and in fact you feel the very important aspect of the way that you work with people. People who have cancer in the UK may well have encountered the commonly held view of oncologists that all the testing they need is done by the hospital and that anything else is pretty much unproven and a waste of your money. So you clearly think otherwise. Why?
Okay. Basically, recent studies have shown that the environment of the body's chemistry has a huge impact on whether the genes become damaged or distorted to create cancer in the first place. And there have been some very interesting formal tests recently to show that actually the biochemical environment of the body is critical to whether or not cancer even manifests.
Right.
So by changing that environmental state, the health of the body, the biochemistry, the level of inflammation, you can even prevent that first stage of cancer from occurring. And if cancer has occurred, then, and you're working with your oncologist to eliminate the actual cancer cells, you still want to go back to reversing the state of inflammation that was present before cancer developed.
Right.
And in doing that with some of the functional tests, the one I use in particular from Genova Diagnostics, the NutriVal profile shows how well is the body actually able to digest? How well is the body actually able to absorb? Is there an imbalance in the flora, the bacteria that live in the intestinal tract? We have more organisms in the intestinal tract than we have cells in our entire body by a factor of 10 to 1. And more this has come to light that the health of the intestinal flora fundamentally improves our immune system or works against it, even affects blood sugar levels, can be a precursor to any degenerative diseases. So it's important that not only do we have the flora right, we have the digestion right, we make sure the body is able to assimilate the nutrients. These are all things to help protect the DNA. Even we can measure intracellular levels of antioxidants. So we can look it down to cell function, the health of the body, and restore that. If a person has had cancer and they've been treated, how to then take that body and bring it back up to its normal state. Or if a person is concerned that they could be walking down that road that leads to cancer, what's the most they can do to help prevent? So that's where that came
from. Yeah, I see that. So so with these tests, do any of them stray into sort of a similar territory to the ones that the hospital's trying to track, which is much more to do with the actual cancer itself?
There's a test that has emerged since we last spoke, since we talked about the book, that comes out of a lab called Medivectum in Germany. And they're actually doing that. They're saying, okay, we can now measure, they can measure 80 different gene markers from circulating tumor cells.
Right.
And to show specifically, one, if there are circulating tumor cells, if the chemistry of the body from the urine shows the body's in the state of fighting at the moment cancer, and then if it, they do pick up circulating tumor cells, they can actually map out what medications will work against that tumor and what medications won't, and medications that will have a moderate effect but not enough of an effect against the tumor. So then the oncologist can pick from that list the drugs most likely to work against that individual's tumor, because the tumor could be the primary tumor in the circulating tumor cells, or it could be a metastasis, which is mutated. This can tell the difference and give you the full map of the drugs that will work against the full range of the cancers present, and also the drugs that won't work very well. So that's new, coming out of Germany.
That's a very sophisticated test.
Very sophisticated test. And then you get a list, and then you take that back to the oncologist and say, these are all the genes. They will be familiar with these gene markers.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't information they're not aware of, but this level of testing, looking at all 80 genetic markers, hasn't been available as a single package.
Mm-hmm.
They may test one or two. So now this is available, and you can take it back to the oncologist and say, these are the drugs that have been tested to work against the tumor.
Right, so that's directly adding to then what they're looking for generally. That's a really great resource.
And then you can also, they can monitor if a person's gone from a state of remission, if the chemistry of the body is indicating that they're starting to go back into a state of fighting again, the immune system's becoming active much before it would show up on a scan.
Right.
So they can monitor the success of the treatment, the right medications, and to make sure that the chemistry of the body is staying safe to prevent.
Mm.
So that's what this lab, Medivectum, does.
Mm. And the recommendation of the medications, is that based on what they find as opposed to testing on what they find? It's a test. So they actually try out the drugs against them. So it's like chemosensitivity testing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one aspect of it is chemosensitivity testing. Another aspect are the organic acids in the urine to look at other aspects of the immune system fighting. So it's a combination of both.
Mm. Right. Okay. I was unaware of that. So what you're involved with generally here, the Genova diagnostic tests, these are described as functional tests. Why? Where's the name come from? Why are they called functional tests?
Because they determine the normal state of function of the body. They're not looking for pathologies or imbalances.
Mm-hmm.
They're assessing the actual normal function of the body. So you can optimize, fine-tune, and restore normal function.
Mm. Okay. So clearly there's a lot of tests you could do, many of which might be helpful. Can we run through the ones that you most commonly use when you're working with people with cancer, and what makes you choose to use those particular tests?
Well, I always use the NutriVal as the base test.
The baseline, because it's very broad. Yeah?
So it's very broad, and it helps me know where the weak spots are in terms of the basic chemistry of the body. Then the next test I would use would be the complete hormone test. That's a urine test, and that looks to see at the level of female hormones and how they're metabolized and methylated, male hormones, how they're metabolized, methylated, the adrenal hormones, the ratio of the hormones that help build up the system versus the hormones that tear it down, the anabolic and catabolic hormones. And you can see the different components that can be adjusted through the diet to help shift the balance into a healthy anabolic state, reducing inflammation, and helping the body properly metabolize the reproductive hormones, both androgens and estrogens.
So you'd be more likely to adopt that test in the case of a sort of classically hormone-driven cancer, presumably, is that?
Or if a person, and generally it would be a woman in particular, wants to know and make sure that she's not at risk for developing a hormone-based cancer, you can make sure that how the body's metabolizing the estrogens and the ratio of the 2-hydroxyestrones which is one of the positive estrogen metabolites, and the 4-hydroxyestrones and 16-hydroxyestrones, essentially the good and bad estrogens, make sure that ratio is at the proper balance so that there isn't a fundamental inflammation or an effect of damaging the genes from hormone metabolites, which can happen. Or to make sure the body's able to detoxify the hormones once they've been used, the methylation pathways.
Okay, and any other tests that you might use with cancer patients?
The genomics tests, which tell me the fundamental metabolic function of the liver in particular and detoxification pathways, to know in terms of exposure to environmental poisons, how well the body is able to break those down, or even the exposure to certain medications, and support the liver's pathways, the balance of the phase one and phase two pathways of liver detoxification, because each of these can be supported in balance, that you can put the body into its the closest to a healthy state possible.
Right, so you're looking out for obviously people who've got a bit of a dysfunction of the liver, or maybe liver damage from some horrendous happening in the past that might be contributing to their condition.
Or a genetic weakness that preceded the beginning of the cancer.
Right.
Which is where the environment led to the beginning of the breakdown, which developed the cancer.
Okay. So how about, are there some things which you'd use in unusual circumstances? So you'd bring them in very specific circumstances with, you know, either very specific cancers or a very specific point in a person's treatment or illness.
The NutriVal would be general for, I feel, for almost all cases, because that gives me the roadmap. And in terms of if a person is about to embark on a course of chemotherapy or radiotherapy, the Medivectin gene test, so that then they can help the oncologist ideally. But beyond those two, I would really see how a person's doing to see where I can fit in, what support we can use nutritionally, because the whole point is to help the oncologist and their medicine to work in the most efficient way and help the immune system respond. Because everybody agrees, ultimately, it's up to the immune system to police the body and prevent any recurrence of cancer. So if a treatment that fights the cancer also suppresses the immune system, a person's still left at risk. So we want to support the immune system while the main drugs eliminate the cancer.
And how about allergic reactions? I mean, some people maybe have suffered for years from an allergic reaction. They don't know what it is exactly, which is maybe causing consistent state of inflammation. If you found that a patient was generally inflamed, would you go looking for that kind of thing?
Yes. That's another variety of tests. The lab that I use primarily for that type of testing is Cyrex Labs.
Right.
And they've found that people who, and they can measure this, are gluten sensitive or wheat sensitive, create an autoimmune reaction. And they've even found a series of foods, primarily foods, that cross-react with the gluten pathways that create, again, autoimmune reactions. So you have a series of foods that can actually trigger a constant state of inflammation and a state of malabsorption. So by doing a simple blood test for those, we can tell a patient what they need to eliminate from their diet so their body can recover and they can assimilate. And there are also some specific, there's a panel that they have showing other chemicals that the person has a very strong immune reaction to as well. So we can know that and remove any other triggers so that there isn't an ongoing, unknown source of inflammation.
So when you say chemicals, you're talking about synthetic chemicals, as in cleaning products and things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, and how accurate do you find these kind of tests are these days? I mean, is it literally you just do the test, they give you the results, all right, that's it, fixed. You know, are they pretty spot on now?
Yes, they're very spot on. I mean, for example, in the gluten category, they're measuring two different forms of antibodies and they're measuring 25 different aspects of the gluten molecule just as that person is gluten sensitive. And with the cross-reactive foods, it's the same. So it's very specific, very reproducible, and they have all the top certifications from the U.S. government. It's a U.S. lab.
Great. Okay, so maybe we can look now at the pathway that somebody goes through from diagnosis through treatment, end of treatment, going through onto trying to recover full health. And are there particular staging posts at which you feel you'd like to intervene and find out what's going on with a particular kind of tests, or is it more general than that? Just assuming somebody presented to you on day one, they've just been diagnosed.
All things being equal, the ideal thing in that day one would be to do the Nutrival and the Medivectim.
Mm-hmm.
And then find out what the oncologist's plan was. I then know what the environment of the body's health is, and understanding what the formal treatment's going to be from the oncologist, developing a program that will support that and support the immune system so that from day one, a patient has the benefit of both of these worlds.
Right.
That would be, and that's where I would start.
Right. But throughout treatment, you'd be presumably wanting to monitor how effective your program of nutrition and whatever it is.
Correct.
Is going to be. So you go back to the Nutrival test?
They can follow up with a urine-only test.
Okay.
Called the Optimal Nutritional Evaluation, the mm-hmm. one test,
right.
which is the same information of the Nutrival without the blood being drawn. And you can monitor how each of these different systems are responding, where the weaknesses are, so you can see step by step.
That's very useful.
If your treatment is working.
Great. And still, say you get to the end of treatment, so they've had orthodox therapy, they've obviously dealt with a lot of toxins, all the rest of it, along the way. Their immune system's taken a bashing, and they're now coming back to you and saying, right, okay, that's behind me now. I want to clean my system up as much as possible, move forward, and restore my health as fully as I can. What would be the tools of choice for that period?
If a patient has had the Medivectim test,
hmm.
which is the genetic test for the type of tumor,
yeah.
they also talk about the specific natural nutrients that will be helpful.
Okay,
there's a whole range of the ones that will actually work for that individual person. So you pick from there, and there's immunotherapies in there, herbs, vitamins, immune-supportive therapies. So that gives me the ideal of this is what that individual person needs. As well, the detox genomics profile allows me to know where the weak spots were and what we have to do to support those so that the liver is able to now detoxify, recover from the conventional treatment, and protect it from overloading in future. So that would give me the picture of what a person needs now to restore and keep themselves healthy.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the price tag on this stuff, because this is an issue. I mean, testing clearly has got a good logic to it, a great way to keep track of progress, avoid wasting resources on treatments and processes that are not needed or don't work for you. It certainly makes a lot of sense, but the limiting factor for a lot of people can be the cost. They might be in a position where they're literally having to choose between testing and treatment, and that's a hard choice. How do you help people with those kind of decision making? How would you advise somebody who was in, say, that kind of situation where they had very limited resources?
That's a difficult question. With the Medivectim test, it's expensive.
I imagine
it's
that.
About 2,900 euro.
Right, so that's about best part of 2,000 pounds?
Yeah. So, and I don't have enough experience to say this is a test that's worth, you know, getting a loan or, you know, your ultimate resources. I honestly can't say that. If it was in the realm of possibility financially, I know. In America and Germany, these tests are covered by insurance.
Right.
Yeah, and whether they're covered by insurance, depending in the UK, if a person has private health insurance, they would be. So that's one issue.
Right.
If that is out of the realm of possibility, then the NutriVal still gives me the roadmap. This is where a person's chemistry is at now.
Mm.
What can we do? Where are the weak spots? What can we do to restore the chemistry? So we're doing that to support the body.
Right.
So that would be the one
this
test.
This is
that,
more in the few hundred pounds
yes.
price.
Yes, about 600 pounds.
600 pounds, right. Yeah, okay. So it's a tricky thing to decide. I mean, these new tests are obviously amazing things. I mean, I was talking to Ralph Moss about the OncoBlock test, which sounds amazing, you know. But it's still, you know, I don't know, 1,000 or something pounds. It's a lot of money, you know. So it's even though it might be a great test, that one, to just have regularly to make sure you're in good health. Because it detects cancer unbelievably early, at a time when you can just make a few changes and restore your health. You know, that sort of price tag may still be beyond a lot of people. So the hope is that these things become more commonly used and we actually get them at a sensible price. But something like the test that you've just outlined, of course, has the potential to save a phenomenal amount of wasted expense by the NHS giving useless chemotherapies, if it's accurate. Okay, so after an extended period of worry and challenge, I think it can take a lot for someone to begin to relax into feeling fundamentally okay again, start looking forward in life. It's something that everybody really needs in order for life to be worth living, you know. Do you find that testing plays a part here in restoring confidence to people who've lost their trust in their basic well-being?
Yes. When a person sees their body chemistry improving and because the combination of both feeling better, having tests from the oncologist show that the tumor is in remission, at the same time, the different fundamental components of their health improving, yes, it does restore a lot of confidence.
Mm. So it's these things moving together, really getting a test result that confirms that how they're actually feeling in their body, actually,
yes.
And it's making sense and it's feeling right. So.
And you're giving them the tools to help themselves because diet plays a part, nutrients play a part, helping the liver plays a part, and a person understands what they're doing to participate in their own well-being. It isn't just a matter of going for the medical treatment and hoping that it works. It's a combination of their own attitudes, the oncologist and the medical treatments, the nutrient treatments, and what they do for themselves. So it's a combination of those things. They're investing their energy and they're helping.
Mm. You know, often reported is the point of being actually given the all clear, so to speak, at the end of treatment as being one of the worst times for cancer patients. And that's because they've been supported up to now and they've just been sent out unsupported. And of course, if they haven't been doing what you just described, which means that they've been entirely dependent on the medical team to get them well, then of course they're literally being ignored as far as they're concerned, left on their own. So very important psychologically to be in the position of being an active participant in your own recovery.
Also, there's a good point made by the medevectin people, which is that there are often small breakaway products, they call them circulating tumor cells,
mm-hmm.
that lodge into the different tissues of the body and go through some slight genetic modification and grow slowly and can manifest years after a primary tumor has been eliminated. So as a heads up from a patient recovering from cancer, they want to now make their body cancer unfriendly.
Yeah.
So having had a successful treatment is certainly step one and an essential step, but they now want to take that as a way of becoming very aware and how to monitor their body and participate in their own health long term.
Mm.
They can't really look away permanently. They want to know that there was a weak spot,
mm.
and the weak spot was significant. They had treatment, it was successful, but that's not the end of the story.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, I like your description of it being step one. That feels about right, yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming on today, Bob. That's very interesting, and thanks also for your fantastic contribution to the cancer revolution.
My pleasure.
That's all for this week. I hope it'll make you want to come back for more next week. And if you've only become a listener recently, you may like to take a look at my past shows in the Listen on Demand section on UK Health Radio. For links to resources mentioned by Drs. Andrew Williams or by Bob Jacob in today's show, go to yestolife.org.uk, click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then choose UK Health Radio. If you want to comment on today's show, then you can find me on Facebook under Robin Daly and on Twitter at RMK_Daly. And please also check out the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, and there on Facebook as Yes to Life and on Twitter at Yes to Life. If you want to be kept informed about the forthcoming book, The Cancer Revolution, then do sign up at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. I hope you'll be able to join me again next week when I'll be continuing my exploration of the cancer revolution. Goodbye.